Marty Glickman, known to generations of football and basketball fans as an especially energetic and innovative play-by-play announcer, was also a terrific athlete. He should have competed in the 1936 Olympic Games, and the story of how that opportunity was taken from him is at the center of a new HBO documentary titled Glickman. Joining me is filmmaker Jim Friedman. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on, Bill. I appreciate it.
Okay, Marty Glickman, 18 years old, was one of two Jewish runners pulled from the competition at the 36 Games in Berlin by the coaches of the U.S. team and the chairman of the U.S. delegation. Why?
Some people believe it was track politics, and the assistant head track coach, Dean Cromwell, was showing favoritism towards his two USC sprinters. But Marty, not at the time, but he later learned, and many people, and I'm one of them, believe that it was anti-Semitism. Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller, the only two Jewish runners on the U.S. track team, were scheduled to race. Well, they were replaced the morning of the day of the race with this bogus story by the U.S. coaches that the Germans were hiding world-class sprinters to upset the American team in the race. So Marty and Sam Stoller were replaced by Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf, and sure enough, we won the race by 15 yards. And it was something that Marty Glickman later learned, as did the public, that Dean Cromwell and Avery Brundage, the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee at that time, were Nazi sympathizers. They were supporters of an organization, America First, which in its latter years did not want the U.S. to enter the war against Germany. And if that weren't proof enough, 2 years after the Olympics, when the Nazis were going to build the German embassy in Washington, D.C., they awarded the construction contract to Avery Brundage's company.
We're going to talk about Marty Glickman's long and very successful career as a broadcaster shortly, but first I want to skip ahead to when Marty Glickman returned to Berlin in 1985. He entered the stadium where he had been deprived of the opportunity to run in 1936, and in the documentary, he describes his feelings at that time.
I looked at the place where Hitler and Goering and Goebbels and Hecht and all the other Nazi hierarchy sat during the games, and suddenly a wave of anger engulfed me. I began to curse out loud, yelling at the individuals, now all dead, like Robinson and Cromwell and Brundage and all. I was actually dizzy, feeling such rage that I thought I was going to pass out. How those no good sons of bitches could have kept an 18-year-old kid from competing in those games so long ago.
This is a powerful thing to hear, and it seems to me that that is in part because for the previous 49 years, Marty Glickman had done such a spectacular job of putting the disappointment behind him. Would you agree?
For the most part, yes. I used to work for Marty. I was 17. I produced his radio show, and I didn't even know his story. Whatever happened to him, he just moved forward with such style and grace that it didn't really show. And then he was shocked 50 years later when he was walking around this track cursing and yelling, as he explained, and this was not a man who did that, that all of this had been within him. But what I loved about that moment was Marty Glickman was not just sad for himself. He was sad that this could have been done to any 18-year-old kid.
For people unfortunate enough to have missed Marty Glickman during the 23 years that he was broadcasting New York Giants games, we'll play a bit of a call from the era of Y.A. Tittle, Kyle Rote, and Frank Gifford, among others. Let's just listen.
The field is 22. Tittle takes it. Goes back to pass, looking downfield, throws angling to the right side, completes to Morrison. Morrison going all the way. Touchdown! One, two, three passes. Touchdown, Giants!
A lot of the younger play-by-play announcers in the documentary celebrate Glickman's energy and his ability to create a picture for people listening to the game on the radio. Is it accurate to say, as Bob Costas does in the film, that Glickman created, quote, a theater of the mind?
Absolutely. Marty Glickman, prior to doing those Giants games, was really the pioneer of radio basketball play-by-play. He gave a geography to the court, to the listener at home. You saw the game. As Larry King said, he was television on radio.
Marty Glickman gets a lot of credit for popularizing the NBA, but ironically, when the NBA first got a national contract, Glickman was passed over in favor of Lindsey Nelson for reasons that had, I gather, nothing to do with his work. Have I got that right?
You've got that right. In fairness to NBC and the NBA, this was an era where everyone wanted to see the all-American middle-class person. Every movie, the movie stars all changed their names. It wasn't Dino Crosetti, it was Dean Martin. Everybody changed their name. And Marty was very proud of being Jewish. He always said he didn't want his father to tune into a broadcast and hear, this is Marty Manning or some other name. So he paid a price for that because he was just probably 10 years too soon, maybe even longer. I mean, the first national Jewish broadcaster in this country, probably, who was a known Jewish broadcaster, was Howard Cosell.
Jim, we should also probably mention Marty Glickman's versatility. I mean, this was a guy who could broadcast a marbles competition.
Near the end of the film, I state all the things he did, and it just is unbelievable. I mean, you know, all these track meets and 1,000 football games and over 3,000 basketball games, 15,000 horse races, 13 years of the Paramount newsreels as their narrator, 16 years of the high school game of the week, and of course, 4 marble tournaments, which he was always very proud to say he did that. For some reason, I don't know why.
There's a moment toward the end of the film that I found particularly powerful. It involves Marty Glickman's recollection of a fellow track athlete named Suzuki. Tell us a little bit about that relationship, please.
Avery Brundage took the Olympians on a tour of Europe to race in France and England and other places. Marty was racing against this Japanese sprinter, Suzuki. Marty won the race. He beat Frank Wyckoff. Suzuki finished third. And he says as he was walking back to the starting line, he felt a tap on his shoulder, and Suzuki with these warm brown eyes smiling at him. And they had an empathy together as athletes. Later in World War II, Marty served. He enlisted and served in the Marshall Islands. And Marty read a story how Suzuki had been killed in the landings on Luzon. And he cried. And he said, can you imagine an American Marine crying for a Japanese soldat? But that's what sports can do. To Marty Glickman, his life was about the joy of sport.
Jim Friedman is the filmmaker behind the documentary Glickman. Jim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Music Emporium, for 45 years offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars. TheMusicEmporium.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel. Now at Radio Shack. This is NPR.